Hey, New York City. Steven from the Novelizers here with amazing news. We're having our first Novelizers live show ever at Caveat in Manhattan, featuring some of our favorite scenes from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, hosted by Dave Hill, with Bob's Burgers, John Benjamin, from Kids in the Hall, Dave Foley, and from SNL, Chris Redd. It's happening Wednesday, July 9th, 7 p.m. at Caveat. The Novelizers Live. Go to caveat.nyc for details and to buy tickets. See you there.
This week on the show, Darcy Ratliff, Jason Mantzoukas, Tony Zaret, plus me, Dave Hill. Thank you. It's the Novelizers.
Don't want your popcorn. Don't want your milk duds. Don't want my shoes stuck in pools of sticky cola. Don't show me romance. Don't show me fist fights. Just show me words printed out under the book lights. Yeah, baby, Novelize the movie. Give me sentences, paragraphs, nothing to see. Novelize the movie. Write a book, turn it into a podcast.
Welcome to the Novelizers. We've got a great show. And believe it or not, we have a special surprise guest in the studio this week. You're not going to believe this.
Is it me?
Steve Agee. It's Steve.
Might as well be you. I'm back.
Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, it wouldn't be the same without you anymore.
Literally.
How are you doing this week? And how is it? How do you feel differently than last week?
Pretty good. I'm really enjoying the section of these intros where we say where we are in the story now, because I'm learning about the movie that I haven't seen.
Oh, no. My God. Man, this is a good episode. Who do we have on the show this week? Someone tell me.
I'm glad you asked. Darcy Ratliff is Kitten Pants, a former publisher of online humor mag, kittenpants.com, producer of films, CDs, live events, and a podcast. She also hosts an annual comedy writer's retreat.
And in addition to that, we've got Jason Mantzoukas, actor, comedian, and writer known for his roles in The League, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, The Good Place, and the How Did This Get Made podcast. He's also voiced characters in Big Mouth and Close Enough.
And my buddy Tony Zaret is a comedian and content creator known for his satirical social media posts and videos that parody internet culture. It's funny. He's a lot funnier than that description makes him sound. He's super funny.
That sounded great. This show is so great. I would support it on Patreon. I'd go to Patreon and search the Novelizers and give you all my money.
Do it. And not only you, Dave Hill, but even listeners are able to search us up on Patreon.
They can do it.
Yeah.
Where are we in the story? I hit my head.
Glad you asked, Dave. Sorry about your head, by the way.
It's okay.
Baby confronts her father for his anger. Baby discovers that Johnny was fired anyway because of his relationship with her. Johnny tries to make amends with Baby's father, but after Doc accuses him of abandoning Penny, thinking Johnny was the one who got her pregnant, Johnny leaves in frustration.
I hate frustration.
I hate it too.
It's one of my least favorite emotions.
Yeah. It's so frustrating.
Very frustrating.
Jason Mantzoukas. Novelize me.
Jason Mantzoukas reading Dirty Dancing, Chapter 15, Meet Me in the Bathroom. As Baby rounded the corner of Fifth Avenue, she could see her father sitting on the steps of their Park Slope brownstone. A young couple and their French bulldog walked past, but he didn't notice. He just stared ahead, seemingly catatonic. The air was thick with the smell of summer in the city, old cigars and hot garbage. And as she approached, Baby knew he could see her coming. She stopped at the foot of the steps and waited for him to acknowledge her, but he wouldn't even look up. After a pause so pregnant it needed his medical attention, she sighed heavily and let her messenger bag fall gently off her shoulder to the ground. "So that's it?" she asked. "You're just never going to speak to me again?" Dr. Hausman didn't answer. "Look, I'm sorry if I embarrassed you, but Jesus Christ, Dad, it's 2001. Girls have sex before marriage. It's not the end of the world." Baby glanced down at her dress, making a mental note to change into something sexier before meeting up with Johnny later. She looked back at her dad, who is still refusing to make eye contact. This little standoff was becoming boring. But she had to try again, minus the attitude. She tried a more sincere approach. I get it. I lied. But you lied too, Daddy. This got his attention, and he turned to face her. You said everyone was equal. Everyone deserved a fair chance. But you only meant people like you. Johnny's not like you. He's not like anyone I've ever met, Daddy. Baby's voice broke a little as she struggled to find the right words. She took a seat next to her father on the steps. You know how most people, when they want to know something about gorillas, they just go to the internet and type in gorillas. Or maybe if they're really interested, they watch a movie or two, read a book or something, right? But then some people are seriously into gorillas. So they get a job at a zoo, okay? They go to work 5 days a week for gorillas. Like, real commitment. Dr. Hausman glanced at his daughter, confused and a little concerned at the direction the conversation had taken. And then there's Diane Fossey. Diane Fossey made gorillas her whole life. She left home and moved to the jungle to live with gorillas 24/7, eating with them, sleeping with them, surrounded by them at all times. That's how into gorillas she was. It consumed her. She spent the rest of her days with gorillas forever. Baby, choking back tears, locked eyes with her father, begging him to understand. Johnny's the Diane Fossey of pussy. She saw her father's upper lip tremble as he struggled to maintain his composure. He's just like unbelievably devoted to it, she continued. Really doing the Lord's work, you know? As she looked at her father, desperate for acceptance, Baby felt no connection whatsoever. She realized he's never gonna get it. She gave up and resumed the attitude. Look, just give me the summer, okay? Next month, I'll go to college, I'll study law, I'll date an econ major, I'll take that stupid internship at the World Trade Center, whatever you want. But until then, baby's gotta live. She grabbed her messenger bag and stomped up the steps to the brownstone, barely noticing as her father sobbed quietly, his face buried in his hands. Johnny hurried along Grand Street towards Lux, a small, dark dance club and a reliable place to find loud music, cheap drinks, dozens of skinny, queer hipsters, and his girlfriend, Baby. The sidewalks of Williamsburg were more crowded than usual. The thick smell of old cigars and hot garbage lingered in the warm summer air. As he entered the club, he quickly scanned a sea of sweaty faces and tight shirts until he found Baby. He moved through the crowd and joined her in front of the stage where a couple of weirdos in ski masks screamed along to a song that seemed to ridicule the very audience it was delighting. It was too loud to talk, so Johnny gently guided Baby toward the back of the room. He pushed open the bathroom door, relieved to find it empty and less disgusting than usual. The night was young. A paper sign was taped to the mirror above the sink, informing guests in black Sharpie, "Sink is broken. Please do not fuck on it." With the door closed and tenuously locked, Johnny could finally hear himself think. "I've been looking for you all over," he smiled and paused for effect. "They got the Schumachers. Turns out they've been scamming people in 3 states. You were right." Baby let out a sigh of relief, a weak smile breaking through the exhaustion in her face. "So it's okay then?" she whispered, reaching out to pull him close, clutching his dumb leather jacket. I told you it would work out, didn't I?" Johnny leaned back, his face serious. "It's over, baby. They fired me anyway." Baby stepped back, stunned, as he continued. "Said they'd give me a little bonus if I left quietly." "Motherfuckers," Baby exclaimed, dramatically. She began angrily pacing back and forth across the dingy room. "So I did it for nothing? My dad hates me? You're leaving anyway? I did it for nothing?" "No, not nothing, baby," Johnny argued, a little hurt. "You did it for me. You did it for us. You did it for three nights of relatively interesting sex with a man twice your age and half your education. Baby leaned against the door and hung her head, unconvinced. Johnny slid his leather jacket off as he approached her and began to wrap it around her shoulders. She stepped away annoyed. No! Stop! Why? It's fucking summer! She mumbled. She walked over to lean on the sink, noticed the sign, and thought better of it. Johnny shrugged, put his leather jacket back on, and smiled. Okay, fine. You did it for free dance lessons and some watermelon and, I don't know, the chance to escape an awkward finger blast situation with Neil. That's not nothing. Baby had no choice but to agree. She was over it. Let's get it wet, John, she said suggestively. And then it got gross. Early the next morning, Johnny stood outside the Houseman brownstone, determined to win the approval of his underage girlfriend's father with his patented combination of charisma, unemployment, and slick back hair, I guess? He knocked on the door and waited, nervously, until Dr. Houseman opened it. Johnny removed his sunglasses, eyes cast downward. Dr. Houseman, could I... He stammered a little as he met the doctor's stone-cold gaze. Look, I know what you probably think of me. You don't know what I think, Houseman interjected. He couldn't believe this idiot had the balls to show his face. You don't know anything about me. Johnny cleared his throat, steadying himself. I know you want your daughter to be someone people look up to. You don't know what I want, Houseman shouted. You don't know where I want people to look. Johnny took a deep breath and tried again. Your daughter's amazing, sir. She's not like anyone I've ever met. She's like... The wind surged, rustling the leaves on the stoop, momentarily distracting them both. The cloying, rancid odor of old cigars and hot garbage made Johnny retch a little. Someday, he'd associate this smell with the best summer of his life. But at the moment, he found it super yoinks. No thank you. He refocused and continued. Your daughter's the only person who ever believed in me. Ever made me believe in myself. Makes me think I could do anything. Like go back to school or get my pilot's license. Or go live in a field in Pennsylvania, maybe. Sky's the limit for me, Dr. Houseman. And that's all thanks to baby. Houseman remained cold, unmoved. Johnny sighed. He was stumped. Sir, have you ever heard of Diane Fossey? Get the fuck off my porch, son, Houseman snapped. Yep, fair enough, said Johnny. He put his sunglasses on, turned, and jogged down the steps, waving at Dr. Houseman without looking back. See you at the big talent show, I guess. Don't tell me when to see, Houseman shouted, really scraping the bottom of the barrel for weird things to yell angrily. I'll see whatever I want, whenever I want. I suppose that's what you would see, sir, Johnny mumbled as he strolled coolly towards the subway station, his stupid leather jacket glistening in the morning sun.
Thank you, Jason. We'll be right back after this.
And we're back. Each week on the show, we interview someone who worked on the film Dirty Dancing. I don't know, Steve, do you want to hear that interview now?
Yeah, you know what? Let's hear that interview.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the interview portion of The Novelizers. I am Kevin Carter, and I'm here with Tony, who was, get this, the weapons handler for the movie Dirty Dancing. Tony, how's it going today?
Oh, it's going great. I've handled so many weapons today, swords, guns. I mean, I love my job. I love handling weapons. So I basically get to do it all day. And yeah, I'm feeling good. I actually recently kind of got the all clear from the whole Alec Baldwin lawsuit. I will not fail. So
Congrats.
I'm basically, I feel like I'm floating. Just hopefully he goes away for a long time.
That's good. So
not my fault.
Yeah, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. Listen, you're good. You found not guilty or however you want to call it. You're here. You're here today. And that's what's important. So I'm gonna have to ask the elephant in the room, address the elephant in the room. What were you doing? What were you handling on Dirty Dancing to be the weapons handler?
Well, just to be full disclosure, it was a little bit of a nepotism situation. Mm-hmm. The director of the movie was my uncle, and I just finished college, and you know, I wasn't really actively looking for work. I was just kind of more focusing on my partying and my really just that. And then my parents said, "You got to get a job." And you know, I always loved weapons. You know, just shooting them, swords, knives. And so they basically said, "Okay, you can go work on this movie, and you know, you get paid as weapons handler because you love doing it." And there was, you know, unfortunately, I had looked at the script and there weren't any weapons, but I showed up with just a truckload of them. And every day on set, you know, I would be going, "Hey, before we start shooting," sometimes once the shoot, even after the shooting already started, interrupting, going, "Hey, maybe we could use a weapon in this scene." And it never really came up. I would, a few times I ran on with some guns and knives and just sort of scared people, thinking maybe it would make it make scene more exciting. But yeah, it was basically just as a favor to my parents that I got that job.
Really? So did they know somebody within the business to get you that job?
Yeah, the director, Emil Ardolino, was my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
Through marriage. That's how we have different names. Yeah. So that was how my parents basically forced him to give me the job. He did not want a weapons handler on the set, but he changed his mind pretty quick when I showed him my Glock.
Yeah. So, That's normally how that happens. Yeah. Was there a scene that you can help with the audience? Is there a specific scene maybe in the movie where you felt like was truly the best place to have the weapon? Like this place right here deserves a weapon, and it didn't happen.
Absolutely. So I'm sure we all remember the classic scene, the big dance at the end, where Jennifer Grey runs up to Patrick Swayze and he picks her up and kind of holds her up in the air. I thought this is kind of boring. I think she comes at him, and then I had this thing. I had a Luger and a Glock. And I was going to have him pull out one, bam, Luger right to the forehead. I don't know. Obviously, this is a podcast, but I pointed my forehead. And the Glock, bam, right in the chest. Blood all over the floor. And then her dad, obviously is mad. Mm-hmm. He is not a gun owner. You know, so, but what he does, he's got a sword. Mm-hmm. And Swayze is so excited from having shot the girl who was coming at him for the dance that he's not paying attention. And the dad, Jerry Orbach, comes at Swayze with the sword, lops his head right off.
Yeah.
And then while the head's going in the air, everybody in the audience is armed to the gills. They're going pop, 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 shooting at the head. Mm-hmm. And there's this, I mean, they're basically 100 bullets just splatter the head everywhere. And I go to the director, you know, my aunt's husband, and I'm going, "Let's put this in the movie." And they didn't do it. And I'm looking at the box office. The movie earned $214 million, but if they had had my scene with the head getting lopped off of the shooting, we would have had $215 million, $216 million, but that's money they left on the table.
Exactly. So, because right now, I'm assuming the movie was more like a romance, you know, like a romance movie, whatever, right? So just that last part, when you talk about just the last scene with the guns blazing every night, that would turn it into, would it be an action or like a gore situation? Because that seems very graphic.
I would call it action because the great thing is, if that had been in there, unfortunately, I mean, and you know, I suppose times have changed, maybe this is going to come up as sexist, but it was kind of seen as a movie for girls. Mm-hmm. But if they had had that part, we would have had the girls, we would have had, you know, the guys. It would have been a little something for everybody instead of this romance thing about, you know, learning how to dance with a hot dance teacher. It would have had, it could have said on the poster, you know, I'm looking at the thing. What's the tagline now? It was something about I can't read. Unfortunately, I don't have a good view of it. But it would have been like, you know, love dance. Mm-hmm. Let me hang on 1 second. Dirty Dancing tagline. I gotta do a new one. First dance, first love, time of your life. It could have been first dance, first love, time to die.
And then that's pretty good.
And that gets in the guys because you know, you have to remember this was the golden age of action films. You got, you know, the Predator, the Terminator, and all this stuff. And they were leaving Predator fan money on the table by not having first dance, first love, time to die.
Yeah, that's
and then
that's,
having that's the shootout good. I came yeah. up with, but
that's pretty good. Yeah. You know, so as the weapons hand, like, are all of these your weapons, or is it like you get it from a like a rental place or something? How does that work? You know what I'm saying? When it comes to having weapons on set and stuff.
Well, basically, just the night before, I had a lot of, I don't know if I could say this, cocaine, and I would just go around town and just trade that for weapons, because I was only, you know, I mean, the bricks of it that I had were massive, and I could only, you know, toot a little bit at a time. So that was plenty enough to get sort of
get weapons and stuff.
Yeah. And the people that got the cocaine were getting a really good deal, because they could resell that for much more than these guns, which they gave me. So that's how I got them and brought them to the set.
Yeah, that makes sense. What is your definition of a weapon?
I would just say, anything could be a weapon in the hands of a master like myself. Like, for example, sure, we know a gun is a weapon, a sword is a weapon, but, you know, a toothbrush could be a weapon if you turn it around and you jam it in a guy's eye. So and really anything can be a weapon if you believe in yourself. And that's what I've been ever since I got my job in Dirty Dancing, I've been trying to sort of spread that message. And that was another kind of idea I pitched to the producers, which, because, you know, the movie was all about believing in yourself. She didn't think she could do the dancing and all that. And I said, well, let's add another thing. Anything can be a weapon if you believe in yourself. But again, you know, this sort of short, it was sighted kind of movie producers didn't listen to me. And that's why the movie was, it did well, but it was basically a flop compared to what it could have been.
Okay, I like that. It did it did very, very well, but compared to what it could have been, it was a flop.
It could have been bigger than Star Wars. Oh. That's the only other movie I can think of right now. But
with a tagline like that, it definitely could have been with that tagline. Yeah.
And they messed up.
Yeah, so it's interesting when we talk about what defines a weapon, because growing up, I was always told, you know what I'm saying, your mind is your biggest weapon, right? The brain is the biggest weapon. And I tried that. I got punched, you know, because my brain couldn't punch back, you know, but I got hit with an actual weapon. My brain didn't work.
You misinterpreted, President. What they mean is your actual skull, because it's very hard. You go headbutt somebody. Okay. I think a lot of people, you miss it. What you were being overly poetic with your sort of interpretation. When people say the mind is great, they mean you go doom and hit somebody right in the face.
Break
your nose.
That makes perfect sense, because I lost some teeth that day. So
there you go.
Makes perfect sense. Lesson learned. I appreciate that. Was there any mistakes outside of the Baldwin fiasco that you're free of? You're not in trouble.
It's not my fault. He shouldn't have pulled the trigger. I said pull it a little bit.
Exactly.
I didn't say really squeeze. I said give it a little pull. You know, yes, there's live ammo in there, but just don't pull too hard. Listen, I told him about the live ammo. Just give it a little, you know, pull.
It's not like you had a gun to his head, tell him to pull the trigger. I didn't see that happen.
I did. I wasn't to his head. I was standing off. I had a sniper rifle with a sight on him. Like, if you don't pull this,
if you don't slightly pull the trigger, I'm going to shoot you. Okay.
But I was clear that not to really pull on it.
Yeah. So. Listen, as long as you gave him clarity, you know what I'm saying? That's on him at that point, right? You told him everything you need to tell him.
And that's why I'm guilt, no guilt.
Exactly. So was there any issues, like mistakes outside of that, maybe on set sometime that may have got you in trouble or something, or could have?
Yeah, well, you know, I had, I don't know, we talked about Dirty Dancing, but I worked on, I don't know if you remember the movie Sleepless in Seattle. It was a romance movie.
Is that with Tom Hanks?
With Tom Hanks. And Meg Ryan. It was a big hit romance. I got weapon handler on that, and I brought in a lot of dynamite. And basically I'd forgotten about it, and I had just, I left it in a hot truck, in the basement of a store that sells dynamite. And so basically it blew up, the whole city block was gone. And I basically got fired from the movie and they didn't use my idea for a dynamite scene where, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, strapped dynamite to themselves to do a suicide bombing, and then that scene got cut, and I would have gotten paid a lot because I wrote that scene.
They didn't use it.
Nope. And if you've seen the movie, you're waiting, okay, they're gonna blow themselves up any minute, and then the movie just ends, and it again would have been a huge movie. I mean, it was still popular, but again would have been more popular.
Oh wow.
Another mistake.
Yeah, another mistake on them, right? It was a huge flop. Huge flop. Now, have you ever heard of the movie Expendables?
Yes.
Okay.
Great movie.
Yeah, great movie. I have to say this, and I don't mean no disrespect.
Yeah.
I was looking at the credits after I've seen all four of them. I love them all, right? And that's one of the movies that it's literally muscles and guns, and weapons. That's all it's about, right? Who cares about a plot? So I don't care about that. But I didn't see your name, you know, something like in the credits. And I guess I'm wondering, and maybe the listeners are wondering as well, as a weapons handler, who was a weapons handler on Dirty Dancing and Sleepless in Seattle, why is it that a movie like The Expendables that is all about weapons, they didn't give you that call?
Yeah, it's all nepotism, unfortunately. The weapons handler on The Expendables was also a nephew of the director of The Expendables. So I kind of, the same thing that got me my job, ended up losing me out in that job. And the sad thing is, I would have done a much better job because I showed up on the set of The Expendables with some weapons. And I said, hey, make me the weapons handler or I'm going to take everybody hostage. And then I got arrested. I got arrested for advocating for myself in the workplace, you know, and this is why our economy is going down the tubes, because basically when you try to stand, when you're a little guy like me, you try to stand up for yourself and you end up basically getting arrested for taking hostages. And if taking hostages is a crime, okay, lock me up, you know, which they did, but I'm out and I got work on that Alec Baldwin movie. So everything worked out for the best.
Yeah. I mean,
not for the guy he was in the scene with, obviously, but, you know, for me, since the trial's over and I'm free and clear.
Exactly.
Baldwin's career has got it done, but I'm fine because nobody really knew that I was, you know, my name is not in the sort of press for that.
So do you feel comfortable now, like publicly saying that you're in the clear, even though no one knew your name? You comfortable with that?
Yes, I'm in the clear, and I would love, because I'm looking for work again, and, you know, obviously, we're not getting the same kind of big budget movies as we were back when they did Dirty Dancing. But, you know, if you need to someone in like a TikTok video to shoot at you or to give you some weapons to shoot, if you're doing, you know, these street interviews are big, you know, people go on TikTok, they go on the street, they ask people, you know, like what's the thing and three things you look like and a guy you want to date. These videos are getting a little played out. You go, you know, I don't know. How would I shoot you right in the face when they ask you that?
Yeah.
And this TikTok will, so I just like to sort of pitch myself for the next generation of creators. Let's get more weapons online.
Now, is it possible for you to do weapons handling without real bullets? Like, can you do it without people actually getting hurt? Because a lot of your stuff that you talk about revolves around people, I'm assuming, literally getting hurt. Do you have like rubber bullets or anything?
Rubber bullets? I never thought of that.
Yeah. You never thought of rubber bullets?
No, wow. I just, I guess, you know, I get the gun, I get the live ammo. And I guess in my mind, I guess you could use a rubber bullet or something or a blank, but to me, it's just not that realistic. I mean, a lot of for actors, I think they need to really be in the moment and giving saying, oh, this gun has a blank in it. You know, that's what, it's just not. In the end of the day, that's just, the actors are not going to be able to give a realistic performance because they're going, I have a blank, we just shoot with them. You know what I mean? It's not, I hadn't thought of it, but now that you mentioned it, I will never do that. And don't bother hiring me if you don't want live ammo.
Yeah, not a problem. I have something I want to run by you real quick, if I could. I am in the process of writing like a screenplay. I'm trying to get out there in LA and when I interview somebody, it's like, can you help me out? I'm trying to get out here. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You seem to be a guy with nepotism that can get me in, right? So I'm in the middle of writing a screenplay. Yeah. And the name of it is called Welcome to the Gun Show.
Now,
it's about people who lift weights. It's about bodybuilders. But somebody walks into the gym with a gun and then their guns turns into guns. It's like a gun thing.
Yeah. Well, listen, it sounds like a great movie. I'd love to get you a job. You know, my uncle was a big director. He did Dirty Dancing, but unfortunately he was shot by me. Yeah. I got some sort of new stuff I wanted to show him for the films. And he was like, is there blanks in there? And I was like, are there what's in there? Go ahead. You know, I told him, just be careful. You know, I'm going to be shooting towards you. So make sure to dodge. You know what I mean? I'm shooting right at you. Make sure to get out of the way with the bullets come at you. And he didn't listen. So I'm kind of out of context. I finally worked my way back up again. And then after the Baldwin thing, you know, I'm looking for help too, because my name, you know, was attached to that. So I wish I could help you, but Yeah. Right now, like I said, I think the best move is just shoot it yourself on your phone, put it on TikTok.
And when you say shoot it, you mean like with a camera, not with a...
No, with a gun. Yeah, shoot someone. Shoot, okay. Shoot someone, record okay. yourself shooting right. someone and put it on TikTok, because that'll be huge.
Yeah, that, right that'll now, blow they up don't, immediately. Yeah, yeah. Yes, no pun intended, but that will blow yes. up immediately.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. listen, no. Tony, I want to thank you for a great thank interview you. Here today.
Thank you very much. You
know, we really appreciate you being here.
Oh, well, great. It's great to be here. And like I said, if anyone wants someone to sort of take your movie into a sort of a very high risk area where your insurance will shoot through the roof, that give me a call, because I'll be there with my live ammo.
You heard it here, folks. I'm Kevin Carter. This was Tony, and this is The Novelizers.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. Another episode of The Novelizers in the can. Special thanks to Darcy Ratliff, Jason Mantzoukas, and Stephen Levinson's friend,
Tony Zarrett. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
Coming up next week, we have Nathan Fillion from Firefly, Castle, and The Rookie as our narrator, along with comedian Matt Walsh from Veep for the interview.
How do we get these people? I will never know.
I don't know.
Google?
See you then.
The Novelizers is hosted by Dave Hill with Stephen Levinson and produced by Stephen, Cole Emhoff, Graham Douglas, Kevin Carter, Christine Bullen, Dennis DiClaudio, and Rob Kuttner, and distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. Mixed and edited by Graham Douglas. Music by Cole Emhoff. Art direction by Crystal Dennis. Theme song written by Andrew Lynn and performed by Nick Testa. Follow The Novelizers on Threads, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and support us on Patreon. The Novelizers is an unauthorized work of parody. Copyright 2025, Novelizers LLC. Take us out, Dave Hill.
There was a baby put in the corner. There was a guy who couldn't give your mama boner. He taught her dancing, it took a minute, and she flew into his arms just like an egret. Novelize that movie, write a book, and also read it to me.